This is Radio EcoShock. We're back with historian, psychologist, and author Carolyn Baker. We've been talking about how an economic collapse may actually help to save the world. I have to agree with you with regrets. On our program, we recently had Tim Garrett, the scientist from the University of Utah, and he was explaining we either collapse the fossil economy or we face deadly climate change. But that could be more long-term, and I wonder, do you think peak oil could bring us down first?
Well, actually, what I think is bringing us down first is the economic crisis, which is worldwide. We're looking now at, you know, the dissolution of the dollar. We're looking at ghastly amounts of debt and nations defaulting on their debts. I don't know where this is all going to go, but I know it's not going anywhere good. And many people in the peak oil movement thought that, you know, peak oil would be the first aspect of this collapse. And it turns out that the economic issues came first, although they are very connected with peak oil. It's really hard to say, you know, which one is going to come first or how that's going to play out, because they're all so connected.
Well, certainly the idea of $147 a barrel oil, just the idea of it, shocked a lot of Americans and people around the world into realizing that this isn't an infinite resource. So we may be entering an age of disappointment. The dream is falling apart. Previous expectations won't be met. How can people cope or even turn this to their advantage?
Well, that's the topic and the focus of my book and of the upcoming course that I'm going to be teaching for post-peak living, which the name of the course is entitled Navigating the Coming Chaos. And, you know, the point of writing my book and teaching this course is to assist people in looking deeper than this economic model of unlimited growth and the American dream and owning the house and, you know, the three SUVs and all of these things that industrial civilization has told us we have to have in order to be meaningful human beings, to be, you know, to take our place on the planet, to have a good life. And so, you know, it is through the collapse, I believe, that we're then forced back in within ourselves and to our community, our small communities, our local place, to reconnect with very different values.
You know, it's strange. When you talk like that, something that just came to my mind as I'm looking around my studio area here, almost all of our furniture is used furniture. And it's not necessarily because we're super poor people, but it just seems like it's foolish to go out and ask somebody to cut down even more rainforest to make us some furniture. So do you think that this change of people's expectations will help?
Absolutely, because we're going to be forced to learn skills that are foreign to us at the present time, although some people are starting to learn some of those skills, you know, and live more in a manner that our grandparents and great-grandparents and other ancestors lived, using things fully before throwing them away and considering very carefully what we do want to purchase and how we're going to use it and why we're going to use it. So, you know, I think that's just one of the possible upsides of this collapse process.
And you've been one of the leading advocates of local action and transition towns. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I'm working very closely with Transition Colorado here in Boulder, contributing to their new online newspaper called Transition Times, which is right now the Colorado edition, but it covers all aspects of transition worldwide, and anyone can read it on the internet. And one of the focuses here in Boulder is the Eat Local Resource Campaign, which is inviting people to make a 10% shift in eating locally, purchasing locally in terms of food. We have a very strong consciousness here in Boulder County of the importance of local food. And I go on the internet every day for my daily news digest to gather and bundle news stories. And you know, everywhere I go, I'm seeing stories about food crisis. In fact, there was a story today on Common Dreams. I think it was called, is called Another Summer, Another Food Crisis. food, I believe, is going to be the new oil. It's going to be the new gold of the next generation.
How would people tune into your daily news items?
Simply by going to my website, www.carolynbaker.net. And over on the left-hand corner is a big green button that says click. It's for subscribing to the Daily News Digest. The Daily News Digest is published 7 days a week throughout the year unless I'm traveling or just absolutely unavailable, which is rare. And what I do is I carefully gather and bundle the news that is related to collapse issues as well as stories that present options for navigating those changes, and it's based on a subscription model based on a sliding scale. Many, many people say that they can't live without it. They're addicted to it. They get up every morning and eat their breakfast with a Daily News Digest, and it's kind of created for many people a sense of online community. I'm not alone, you know, and it's very validating to see these stories every day along with the options.
Friends, we're talking with Carolyn Baker. I am intrigued by this new course you talk about because it's something they don't teach in the Harvard Business School, that's for sure. So,
right.
And you're going to do it online so people don't have to drive somewhere and create greenhouse gases and waste all that
right.
money. How is that online teaching going to work?
Well, the way it's going to work is we're going to start on Saturday, April 24th. It's a course that is a duration of 3 hours. I believe it starts at 10 a.m. Pacific time and runs until 1 o'clock with a couple of five-minute breaks. And there's lots of time for discussion and interaction by phone. It's not going to be online chat. It's going to be live conversation by telephone. People can talk with me and with each other, and then I will be available for one-on-one consultation between sessions if people are interested. But that is April 24th, May 1st, May 8th, and May 15th. And to find out more and or to register, people should go to www.postpeakliving.com. And there is a considerable discount in registration fee if one registers by April 10th.
I want to move on to another problem here. How do we get beyond ideas and get past the endless online attractions to do something real in our community?
Well, a lot of people have discovered that that is much more rewarding. Many people who are involved in transition and other organizations are realizing that this whole model of bigger is better and everything must be global, everything must be national, is also unsustainable in that what is happening as these systems deteriorate is that we're realizing things have to become local and changes have to be made on the local level. That is not to say we should ignore the issues that are affecting people on the other side of the world, because in fact we are all connected. But the real solutions or the real options are going to have to be in our local place.
Well, yes, and I think the emphasis has to be on the word community, because as we learned in that book, Bowling Alone, that we've become so individuated and we don't have that much face time with others. And for many people, the religious groups have fallen apart. So it's going to be a real challenge to build up new lines of community.
Well, it is. And I think that as things get more dire, we will be forced to plug into our community, create community with each other. You know, I hear a lot of stories of people who have had experiences with living in eco villages or trying to create intentional communities, and you know, there's been so much conflict, and they've sort of walked away saying, "Oh man, community doesn't work. Don't even tell me about it." And I think that perhaps one of the reasons for that is that right now, creating that kind of close community is sort of a luxury. But as these systems fall apart and we are forced back on, you know, interdepending on each other, some of those nitpicky things that keep us from really coming together will pale by comparison with the need that we have to be interdependent.
You know, we just had an odd experience here in Vancouver. The Olympics were here, and hundreds of thousands of people came out into the streets and sort of ran into each other almost for the first time. There were no protests. It wasn't a police action. In fact, people were giving the police big hugs. So I think that there was an idea there that we can get away from our TVs and meet each other again.
Absolutely. And that will become even more real as we don't have television because we may not have the energy resources to keep them happening, or we may not have the money to pay for cable or whatever. I see the television as something that's a luxury that we can have right now, but we're not going to have it forever. And then what will we do? You know, we can only read so many books. But the point is, we need each other. Nobody in this collapse is going to survive on his or her own. Isolation and rugged individualism is a recipe for death. So we're only going to be able to survive if we become interdependent.
That's something I really like about your work, because your vision seems a lot bigger than digging a concrete hole and filling it full of food, guns, and gold.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What is real survival about?
Real survival is about not only the technological or the logistic preparation, and this is what I really, really emphasize in my book and in this course. We have got to prepare on other levels besides storing the food, storing the water, relearning the skills, all of which are extremely important, but we've got to prepare emotionally and spiritually. And as you begin to envision or imagine a world in collapse where we don't have these resources, we don't have money as we know it, we don't have energy, we don't have all of these things, it's going to be a chaotic world. It's going to be a scary world for many people. And so how are we going to navigate that emotionally with all of the feelings of loss coming up, or the feelings of fear, or the feelings of grief? You know, how do we prepare for those feelings? Because we will feel them.
You do talk about dark emotions. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't consider any emotion particularly dark, but, you know, we've come to think of emotions like grief and fear and despair and, of course, anger as dark. And there's a wonderful book written by a psychologist named Miriam Greenspan entitled Healing Through the Dark Emotions. And I'm going to be using some of her material in my Sacred Demise Level 2 workshop. I'm in the process of creating Levels 1, 2, and 3. These are workshops that I do in different places, not the same as the course that I'm going to be teaching, where we can really face those emotions instead of running from them as most people are doing now, and in that way become more prepared for when those feelings are perhaps more frequent in our world.
I wonder, a lot of this transition planning and action depends on timing. There could be grave penalties for people who don't prepare, but there can be downsides to moving too soon as well. I mean, what if the fossil empire just keeps adding patches and faking it and limps along for the rest of our lifetimes?
You know, that brings up a good point, which is that I think that collapse is going to be both slow and fast. Some people say, well, how long is this going to, you know, is this going to happen quickly or slowly? And I say, yes, it's going to happen in both ways, because I think that it really will be, as James Howard Kunstler says, a long emergency. Loss here and loss there and collapse here and collapse there. But I think there will also be tipping points and serious, immediate kinds of crises like Katrina, like the Chilean earthquake that we just recently witnessed in Haiti, that will move the collapse process along faster. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of limping along for a while, and that's really concerning, because the longer the empire limps along, the more devastation to the environment, and I think to our human souls.
As we wrap up, Carolyn Baker, we have barely scratched the surface of your work and thought. Could you tell us just a couple of the other questions that you might be wrestling with these days?
Well, I think that many people who in the United States were very hopeful about a new candidate of a different party, the first black man in the White House, and all of the hope and change that were promised in the campaign for president. Many progressives and people who are concerned about the environment were certainly hoping that this would make it a huge difference. And now most of those folks are confronting, well, a real disappointment, because I call it Bush 3. I call it the hopium has worn off. And so a lot of folks are saying, so what do we do now? And I wrote an article a couple of months ago, which you can find on my website, called Your Disappointment in Obama is Your Teaching Moment. So it's now an opportunity to come back and look at, what is hope? Well, hope is something that I generate within myself. It's not something that somebody else can give to me. And all of these problems that we're confronting are not about some government, some candidate, some president making it better. It's about us tapping into our inner resources and to coming together with our community to solve these issues or address these issues and respond to them on a local level.
And this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with one of the thought leaders of the coming decade, Carolyn Baker. You will probably want her book, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. Check out her website at carolynbaker.net and look into her online course about preparing for these transition times. Thank you, Carolyn, and I hope you'll join us again.
I certainly will. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex. This is Radio EcoShock, trying hard to be a world-class English language show. Last week we heard from Australia. Of course we do American. And listeners from the UK, you are our number three audience. Now it is Canada's turn, and what a black eye for the beaver tails. While his government was full of green promises, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been caught slashing climate research funds, appointing climate deniers to key government funding positions, and, just like in the dark old Bush days, scheming to muzzle the country's top climate scientists. Here is independent journalist Stephen Leahy interviewing Graham Saul of Climate Action Network.
You're saying that the federal government is stacking boards with people they know are denying climate change is happening?
Yeah, I'm saying that so the Prime Minister's appointed what we would consider three climate change skeptics to boards of the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council and the Canada Foundation for Innovation. And the three individuals' views are pretty much completely at odds with the international scientific consensus on climate change and the views expressed by the government's own ministers.
So these are not scientists that are being appointed to these boards as well?
They're in the report itself. Let me see. So Christopher Essex, a professor and associate chair in the Department of Applied Mathematics at University of Waterloo and former director of its program in theoretical physics. So that sounds like a scientist. In 2002, he wrote a book with Ross McKittrick entitled Taken by Storm, which attempted to challenge the, quote, myth of climate change. And on November 2nd, 2006, he was appointed to the board of the NSERC.
Actually, I know this guy. This guy has sent me emails pointing out the errors in my
stories. So there's him. There's Mark Mullins, who holds a PhD in economics from the London School of Economics and was the executive director of the Fraser Institute, a free market think tank. Between 2003 and 2004, he received $120,000 from ExxonMobil. The Fraser Institute received over $120,000 from ExxonMobil. And he was appointed to the board of the NSERC in 2009. And John Weisenberger holds a PhD in geology from the University of Calgary and has worked in the oil and gas industry, notably Husky Energy in Alberta, for over 20 years. He's a friend of Prime Minister Harper and a former chief of staff in his government, and he was appointed to the board of directors of Canada Foundation for Innovation.
Now, do any of these boards provide funding for climate science in Canada?
Yes. I mean, in the report, there are specific quotes from some of these folks, like Mark Mullins, the climate change issue is somewhat sensational and definitely exaggerated. It strikes me that the science is not settled. Christopher Ethics and Ross McKittrick. The claim that there is a global warming crisis threatening to bring chaos and destruction upon the world is so feeble you were probably feeling skeptical anyways. You were right. Yeah, so these bodies are responsible for providing funding and oversight on climate change research, among other things.
Okay, so this is just one piece of evidence you feel that shows that the federal government is not taking climate change seriously?
Yeah, and the report demonstrates a pattern that includes, as I said, stacking boards responsible for oversight over science with climate change skeptics. It includes policies that effectively muzzle climate change scientists working for Environment Canada, being able to effectively engage the press, and as a result, their engagement with the news media has plummeted over the course of the period that was studied, which was 2007 to 2008. It includes burying reports by releasing them at strange hours after paying consultants significant amounts of money to prepare communication strategies that were then ignored. And it includes allowing funding for key bodies to expire and bringing into question whether or not those bodies which provide essential climate change research will continue.
Give me an example on the funding issue.
Yeah, specifically we're talking about the Canadian Foundation of Climate and Atmospheric Science. So in its 2010 budget, the Government of Canada refused to provide new funds to the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science, which is in many ways the most important funding body for university-based research on climate science in Canada. And our analysis shows that the government's abandonment of CFCAS will likely result in total federal funding for university-based climate science research, excluding infrastructure, falling to less than half of the level at which it has been for the past several years.
Is that for 2010 or is that for the future?
That's for starting in 2011. Basically, they're out of money and they can't make new commitments.
So they cannot engage in new research programs or...
Yeah, if over the course of this year, if they're going to be getting ready to do work next year, they don't have any money for it. Basically, they requested additional money for this budget so that they could ensure continuity in the programs, and they didn't get it.
So programs they have running right now will be terminated?
Yeah, if there's not additional money. I mean, they will not be able to continue with scientific research that is currently happening.
All right. You mentioned also policy of muzzling climate scientists. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, in 2007, Environment Canada brought in a new communications policy that required everybody to go through the communications department. And what they found was that requests from journalists for information on climate science related issues were going unanswered. Scientists were trying to run requests through the communications department. The communications department wasn't getting back to them. So we have this document that demonstrates that one person argues that they had forwarded as much as 30 requests for science interviews to the media relations department, that the approvals to proceed was granted for only about 20% of the cases. In some cases, leading Environment Canada climate change scientists were being denied the opportunity to talk to journalists. In other cases, the responses were just taking so long that they weren't able to respond to the request in time for the deadlines that journalists were working under. And as a result, media coverage of climate change science reduced by over 80% between 2007 and 2008.
Okay, so you're saying that media coverage in Canada of climate change science, is this just from Environment Canada scientists or just climate change science in general?
Environment Canada. A review of the coverage received in Environment Canada media clippings database over the period January to September indicates that for their three highest profile climate change scientists, media coverage decreased sharply from 2007 to 2008.
What does this mean to the Canadian public? I mean, this what you say is going on?
Well, it says that this government is essentially launching an attack on climate science, as far as I'm concerned. There's a broader pattern here where you've got former ministers questioning the science of climate change in major Canadian newspapers, and you've got a government that is effectively doing nothing on climate change. So it says that they don't can take this issue seriously, and it brings into question whether or not they actually believe their own rhetoric in terms of the need to take action on climate change. It appears to me that they're, in one form or another, burying the truth. whether that's by making it difficult for Environment Canada climate change scientists to talk to the journalists, or it's cutting back on the amount of resources the scientists have to produce good information, or it's burying reports as they come out rather than giving them the profile that they deserve.
Now, why do you think the government is burying the truth about climate change?
Well, I think the government has decided that they intend to do nothing until they're forced to do something. This government has put forward a series of promises. A pattern has developed where the government says it's going to do something about the problem and then it proceeds to do nothing. And then a year later, it says it's going to do something about the problem and then it proceeds to do nothing. And now it's basically openly saying that it has no intention of regulating Canadian industry until the United States does, when the United States is actually moving forward in other ways, including climate change science and investment in renewable energy, currently outspending Canada 14 times to one per capita in terms of investments in renewable energy. So it's a pattern, it's a broader pattern of a government that isn't taking this file seriously. It seems to be, to some degree at least, linked to the fact that they're intent on ensuring that Canadian energy resources, especially the tar sands, emerge unfettered and that growth occurs.
So you're saying that Canada won't be moving into a green economy?
The budget talks, right? The budget is a concrete opportunity for the government to make commitments to create clean energy jobs. And what we saw in the last budget was that this government has no intention of positioning the Canadian economy to be a player in the clean energy economy of the 21st century. There was, you know, the budget was shocking in terms of its total failure to think strategically about how Canada can invest in and benefit from the clean energy economy. That's not happening in the United States. It's not happening in Europe. Those countries are positioning themselves to be leaders in these fields. And it's clear that right now the Canadian government is saying we have no intention of regulating industry. We're not investing in clean energy jobs. And now what we're seeing is that they're also muzzling scientists and making it difficult for good climate science to emerge.
So what's going to be the impact on the Canadian public?
To the degree that this inhibits the Canadian public's access to quality scientific information, then it's going to play the role of dumbing down the debate. I mean, the reality is that there are national academies of science. There is no real debate about humans causing climate change. What we're seeing right now is that the more the government engages in activity that makes it difficult for leading climate change scientists to speak open to the public, the more room it leaves for other people to come in and occupy that space. So, unfortunately, it means that the Canadians are going to be less informed about one of the most urgent issues facing the world today.
Graham, you're with the Climate Action Network, right?
Yeah, Climate Action Network Canada.
And Climate Action Network Canada is?
It's a coalition of leading Canadian organizations working together to push for action on climate change, about 60 organizations.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much, Graham. I appreciate your help.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Lay interviewing Graham Saul at Climate Action Network. Find their report, Troubling Evidence, the Harper Government's Approach to Climate Science Research in Canada, by Andrew Cuddy, as a free PDF download at climateactionnetwork.ca. This was edited for radio by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Go to stephenlahey.com, that's LEAHY.com. Ugly stuff. Canwest ran a story saying climate coverage from government scientists was down 80%, since Mr. Tar Sands went to work in the Canadian capital. And expensive reports get released at crazy hours after the press is gone. Anything to sweep it all under the rug while our north melts, while our species go under. The rest of the planet doesn't get to find out what is happening in the Great White North, in one of the largest and most heavily impacted parts of the globe. That's it for me this week. We opened with a song from 350.org, 350, The People's Priority, by Daisy May and Seth Bernard.